And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The redistricting process in Ohio, well underway, but legal challenges may loom as Republican lawmakers defend the new legislative boundaries, and critics call them unfair and gerrymandered, all familiar arguments during this decennial period. We're joined now by Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporters Joe Ingles. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
And Andy Chow. Andy, welcome to you as well.
Good afternoon.
Well, I've been following your all's reporting on this since the beginning, and there's been a lot of movement on this, from public hearings, from back and forth between political leaders and elected leaders. I want to make sure I fully understand where we are now, because the Ohio Redistricting Commission has approved these maps on a party line vote of 5-2. So, Andy, is that the end of this? Is that the map now?
As far as the Ohio Redistricting Commission's work goes, yes, this is the end of it. They have officially approved these maps, the maps in which Republican Senate President Matt Huffman says basically guarantees 62 House districts to Republicans and 37 House districts to Democrats, 23 Senate districts to Republicans, and 10 Senate districts to Democrats. Those are maps that have been approved by the Ohio Redistricting Commission that are going to be submitted to Secretary of State Frank LaRosa's office. But when it comes to the more likely procedure of everything, it is now up to groups who might want to mount a legal challenge, and we're thinking that's pretty likely the case.
It sounds, Andy, like you just described a secure supermajority in both chambers for the Republicans.
Right. And not necessarily as strong as it is right now. And that has been one of the arguments coming from the Republican leaders, which an argument that's been laughed at by many advocates around the state. But it does guarantee, by their own analysis, guarantees a supermajority for the Republicans in the House and the Senate. And remember, a supermajority means a veto-proof majority. So people like Governor Mike DeWine, who is on the commission, approved a map that can actually guarantee Republicans, most likely guarantee Republicans, a veto-proof majority that can also weaken the power of the executive.
513-419-7100 is our number if you've got questions for Andy and Joe about the redistricting efforts so far in Ohio, 513-419-7100. Joe, I recall Ohio voters putting into law that this redistricting process should be more fair. It has to withstand constitutional scrutiny, does it not? And can you talk a bit about how both sides feel, whether it does?
Well, that's true. They did. In 2015, Ohio voters voted through reforms in legislative redistricting, and those reforms were meant to take the partisanship out of the process. And right now, we know that there is a lot of partisanship in these maps because a lot of the analysts, independent analysts who have looked at it, and the Ohio Democratic Party are saying that about 81% of the seats in the legislative districts total could actually go to Republicans. So that's a pretty strong majority there. The people who have been coming to these hearings are saying that when you have supermajorities, when you have large numbers like that, then a lot of voters, their vote doesn't really count because they can vote, on the issues, vote for people, but it doesn't matter because they're minimized through redistricting. We heard that over and over and over from folks that came to these meetings, especially, people who were advocating on behalf of minorities, people advocating on behalf of low-income people. And, a lot of people were saying, hey, younger people want no part of being in Ohio right now because of a lot of these things that are happening. They feel like they have no voice in government.
So as you mentioned, Joe, I mean, this was supposed to take the partisanship, at least heavy partisanship, out of this redistricting process. But the chairperson of the Ohio Democratic Party had some pretty significant complaints about the process. You wrote about how she argues the Republicans were playing by their own rules here. When we think about what potential, answers there might be for people who feel this is unfair, what are the options on the table? Do they immediately go to court, or is there an appeal process built in?
Well, I think it's a pretty good bet that they're going to go to court. And I don't know exactly which entities are going to take it to court, but there's a lot of talk about various groups or people going to court over this. I think a lot of people are waiting to see how the congressional district, how that shakes out. And I know I talked with Catherine Turser at Common Cause Ohio. She was one of those backers of these reform efforts that are now in place. She's frustrated and disappointed in the legislative maps, but she says she's really looking forward to seeing what happens with these congressional maps, because any action that they take, and that action could be going back to the ballot again with something else, but any of those actions they take, she wants them to be well-researched, have the information they need so that they don't put something on the ballot that doesn't work. So she really wants to learn from this first and then, you know, figure out where they need to go from there.
We're talking to Joe Ingles and Andy Chow, reporters with Ohio Public Radio's State House News Bureau. Andy, what do we know about these maps? This isn't like the congressional setup, right, where Ohio is losing a seat. So we have the same number. It sounds like they are designed to preserve similar numbers to partisan-wise in both chambers at this point. But any surprises in the way they're drawn? Any particular lawmakers that seem to be targeted specifically or might see different districts?
You know, you could go and depending on where you live in the state, it's easier if you're, you know, in your hometown sort of analyzing what's going on. And so I could tell you what's happening in Columbus, where there are different slithers of districts cut up. There's lines that sort of dip into one neighborhood and out into another one. And so these lines are basically drawn in a way that you can have neighbors on one side of the street and the other side of the street voting in completely different state legislative districts. And so, like you were saying, Ohio in the House has 99 House seats and 33 Senate seats. Right now, there are 62 of those 99 seats in the House are going to Republicans, 23 of those 33 seats in the Senate going to Republicans. And so right now at this point, it really doesn't, and this is the argument that advocates are making, it does not reflect the proportionality of Ohio. So when you talk about that, they say, when you look at a statewide race, how many people are voting for the Democrat and how many people are voting for the Republican? If you take a look at that and analyze that over 10 years, you'll see that about 46% of the vote has gone to Democrats and 54% of the vote has gone over to Republicans. Now, Democrats and voter rights advocates have been arguing that that's what the maps should look like. So instead of a 62-37 split, they say it should be more like a 53-46 split. And that's not where the maps are right now.
So Republicans are arguing that, sure, we'll base it on election trends, but we're doing it by share of actual House seats rather than share of the actual electorate.
Yep. And at that point, and that's a really great point, Michael, because that's actually exactly what the argument is coming out from Republican Senate President Matt Huffman. And that's an argument that when you really could try to read the body language of the people on the commission, Governor Mike DeWine, Secretary of State Frank LaRose, and Auditor Keith Faber, that was not necessarily an argument that even they were buying, but still they wanted to vote for it to move the process along. Governor Mike DeWine stopped short of saying that he thinks that there's a good court challenge here, because I think a lot of people don't believe that that's what the proportionality provision of the Constitution meant.
Andy, you were starting to talk about Columbus specifically, since that's the area where you are in the state. And we know that across the country, there's a partisan divide that is very well demonstrated between urban areas and rural areas. And you certainly see that in Ohio, where Democrats tend to have control in the urban areas like Columbus, like Cincinnati, and Republicans take control in the more rural areas typically. Are there any specific lawmakers in your part of Ohio that have seen their district chopped up in a way that might cause them concern for their reelection prospects?
Not necessarily here in Franklin County, because this is a county that has already been moving more towards just basically everybody in Franklin County who has a seat in this district has just been going all towards the Democrats. But what we are looking at, and Joe knows this up in part, the northern part of Franklin County into Delaware County too, is that you see these votes dipping into the urban areas, then on the outskirts of the suburban areas, and then into the rural areas. And then the way you draw that, you could end up discounting some Democratic votes in more of the urban suburban areas by collecting more in the rural areas. And so that's sort of where we're seeing the argument being made from voter rights advocates, saying that these lines and these communities were split up in ways that to just favor Republicans in the end.
We're talking with Andy Chow and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. So, Joe, I mean, the story that came out yesterday is basically that this Ohio Redistricting Commission approved these maps on a party line vote of 5-2. So there's even some partisanship among the commission. When we think of a 5-2 vote, if that's along party lines, it seems a bit disproportionate for our sake. Can you help us understand the makeup of this commission?
Sure. It has to do with statewide elections, a lot of it, because you have the governor who's elected statewide and happens to be Republican. You have the Secretary of State statewide, happens to be Republican. You have the auditor, and he was a statewide Republican. So three positions right there were determined by voters in their choice of who they put in there statewide. Then, of course, they get two Republicans and two Democrats from the legislature. So that's how that's made up. But in answer to the question of whether some areas of the state are, you know, in the rural areas are kind of weird, I live in Delaware County, which is just above Columbus. It's always been pretty red, but it's been trending blue, especially in certain parts of it. It's really gotten more Democrats. So what they've done with the Senate map is they've taken Delaware County and they've gone up and pulled in part of Holmes County. Now, you know, Holmes County is very red, a lot of Amish influence up there. Those two counties are probably have a lot of differences that we don't have time to go into, and they're not like communities. But that's an example of one of the things on this map, at least on the Senate map, that people are looking at saying, wait a minute, what's going on there?
And I think, Michael, if I can jump in,
yeah.
I think what's and what exactly what Joe mentioned is something that Democratic Senator Vernon Sykes mentioned on the commission. Now, this is somebody who's been fighting for fair districts for years now. He was one of the key leaders in making the reforms happen in 2015. And one of the things that he was, I think he even expressed some surprise here, is how the Republicans who drew these maps were able to follow the guardrails that were put into the Constitution when it comes to compactness and line drawing, yet still be able to, in the way he described it, game the system to still favor the Republicans. Now, the rules around line drawing is just one part of the Constitution. That's why we have the rest of the Constitution that talks about things like proportionality. And that should have been sort of the other guardrail to make sure that this didn't happen the way it did, according to his argument. And so that's why I think if this does go to court, that's the proportionality part of it. Again, how Democrats and Republicans statewide vote, I think that's going to be the main argument there.
And we're talking about legislative seats so far in this conversation, Andy, and that's for the State House. That's for the State Senate. They also have to draw lines for congressional seats, and that hasn't happened yet. When should we expect that to happen?
It should be happening soon. And so the process actually starts with the state legislature. So the House needs to come to a vote. The Senate needs to come to a vote. And they need to be able to vote in a way where a certain amount of Democrats, because they are the minority party in the chambers right now, a certain amount of Democrats have to also be on board with whatever proposal is out there. And if that vote does not happen, then again, the Ohio Redistricting Commission, the 7-person panel that we just saw vote on the state legislative maps, they're going to be called up again to take on the congressional maps. A lot of people believe that that is where this process is going at this point.
Well, before we let you all get on with your weekend, your Friday, let's talk a bit about COVID in the state. We know that there's still rumblings about whether there could be a mask mandate in the state of Ohio, and it just doesn't look like there is any political will at the state level. And so school districts are left on their own to make this decision about masks in school, even as we see increasing cases among younger people. And now that we see, of course, kids back in school the way that they always had been. Joe, what's the latest on that development? What are people saying at the state level about masks in schools?
Well, you know, Governor DeWine preaches mask in schools, mask in, you know, inside, you know, listen to the science, all of this. We asked him, we said, if you really feel like that, why don't you issue a mask mandate? He says that Senate Bill 22, which he vetoed, but it's still passed, which takes away a lot of the health orders that he could put out. He doesn't have that authority anymore. He says that prevents him from issuing a statewide mask mandate, even a temporary one, and even just kind of for just schools. He doesn't think he has that authority. So I asked him, I said, well, couldn't you go to court? You know, because he has questioned the constitutionality of that when he vetoed it. And I said, couldn't you go to court and get, you know, that overturned so that you could have a mask mandate? And the answer was basically, well, you could go to court, but you get the courts involved, and some of these school districts who have already on their own put a mask mandate in place, then they're at the mercy of whatever the court rules. And if the court rules the other way, it could take away their ability to be able to do a mask mandate. So that's the answer we're getting so far.
My thanks to Andy Chow and Joe Ingles of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau for spending part of your Friday with us and keeping us so well informed. You can follow their reporting right here on 91.7 WVXU over the air, as well as at statenews.org. Andy, Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, the Cincinnati Police Union president blasts the city's plan to mandate vaccines among employees, and Cincinnati Public Schools becomes the first in the state to mandate vaccines for their employees. And also, we're hearing about students barking at each other in a Northern Kentucky school district, and that is causing some serious concern among administrators and parents. What is going on? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Cincinnati Public Schools employees will need to be vaccinated against COVID-19 following a Board of Education vote, but a similar plan at the city of Cincinnati angered the president of the police union. Let's talk more about that now with Inquirer reporter Cameron Knight. Cameron, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And WVXU reporter I wrote Andy Chow when I meant Corey Sharber. Corey, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for getting it right, Mike.
My apologies. It's Friday. I'm ready for the weekend. Listen, Cameron, it's not like the FOP president in Cincinnati to have harsh words to say towards administrators in the city. What's going on here?
As I understand it, the city manager's office issued a mandate earlier this month that is supposed to go into effect on, I believe, in about a week, maybe a little less than a week. That's sort of the what's becoming a bit of a standard vaccine or weekly testing mandate. So it's not a mandate to get vaccinated, but it's a mandate to either get vaccinated or get a negative COVID test every week so that you can work.
And so that did not sit well with Dan Hills, who is the president of Fraternal Order of Police Lodge 69 here in Cincinnati.
Yeah, correct. So it applies to city workers. And I think it's important to note that the Biden mandate would apply to private workers, whereas city workers are not private. They're public employees. So that's why a city would issue a mandate like this, because this national mandate would not cover public employees.
You're like talking about the mandate that requires businesses with 100 or more employees. And of course, the president is also mandated for federal workers, but the local governments need to do their own thing.
Right, exactly. So the FOP president, Dan Hills, said it was an enormous mistake, and he believes that the policy is politically motivated. He also said that the testing requirements were amounted to a way to harass employees to get vaccinated. He said that he also said that there that the administration is ignoring other ways that people have become immune to COVID-19 or potentially become immune to COVID-19. He mentioned that he himself had tested positive for COVID antibodies, but had never been noticeably sick. So I think in that case, he's saying that he probably has some immunity to it, whereas, and he's never been sick.
Well, this Cameron, is what ends up being the argument at this point in this extended pandemic is there are a couple of ways to protect yourself against a further infection of COVID-19 or a first infection. You can get a vaccine and that will protect you immensely, or you can get COVID-19. And so what exactly is the FOP president suggesting here, that is officers should just get COVID-19?
I think he's suggesting that a lot of officers have been exposed to it already and developed antibodies on their own. I think that's what he's suggesting. I mean, he also says that, his bigger point, I think his broader point was that he believes that vaccination is a personal medical decision that should be made with your doctor, and that your employer shouldn't force you to have to do something that should be a personal choice. I think that was that's sort of his overarching thing. The other thing that he mentioned that I found interesting was that he did basically come straight out and say, this is a quote, "The percentage of officers who are unvaccinated and distraught over these policies are much greater than you probably suspect," which is what he wrote in a letter to the city manager, Paula Boggs-Muthing, and the mayor, John Cranley.
That's the line that really stood out, was that the percentage of officers who are unvaccinated and distraught over these policies, much greater than you probably suspect. And you think of police officers being on the front line in the community to respond to emergencies or criminal activity, potentially exposing themselves consistently throughout a single day to this widespread virus. And yet they have not, apparently at a high level of the number of officers, taken the vaccine, which is widely available and free to them. Did he offer reasons why?
He did not in his letter, and I've spoken to him more broadly on that. I mean, I think I'm sure there's a number of reasons why. I'm just like anyone else in any other profession would maybe not want to get vaccinated. I did find it interesting that the state FOP for Ohio, the Fraternal Order of Police, obviously has sort of a hierarchy, and there is a state level organization that represents sort of police officers at the state level, and they pushed very, very hard to get police officers vaccinated as quickly as possible. They wanted them to be among the very first to get vaccinated, and while they were in those early groups, I'm not sure they were in the very first group. There is some messaging there that as a union president, you have as a union in general, you have sort of a dichotomy where you're always supposed to be representing your employees. So you're simultaneously trying to represent them to get them the best options available. But then if you find out that your membership does not want to participate in a thing, then your job is then to represent them in that fight as well. So it's a odd situation that unions find themselves in, I think.
That's Cameron Knight from The Inquirer. We'll come back to you in a moment, Cameron. Let's turn now to Corey Sharper from here at WVXU, where a similar mandate is now in place at Cincinnati Public Schools following a Board of Education vote. So who does this apply to, Corey?
This will apply to all employees and co-located partners within the district, and co-located partners include anyone from the health partners working with the district, resource coordinators, school resource officers, and anyone else that's working outside of a school building.
You said co-located partners, and I hope I'm not putting you on the spot here, Corey, because it just occurs to me that there are school resource officers inside Cincinnati Public Schools, and they are usually police officers. So do we know how that impacts the police union's position? Will these officers have to get a vaccine?
I haven't looked into that. Yes, so you definitely are putting me on spot, Michael. But
well, there's a story for you to work on today. Just put that on your
agenda. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm gonna have to write that down. That's a good one.
I didn't mean to be the assignment editor in addition to being the host of this. I honestly just hit me while we were talking because you said co-located partners. And obviously that is a relationship between the school district and the police department. So I would certainly be curious to find out. Are we hearing any pushback from employees the way we are from the police department at the city level?
I haven't heard any direct pushback from employees in the district, but interim superintendent Tiana Amott, she did raise concerns during the meeting that the policy could lead to staff leaving the district. However, they did specifically put in this new policy that if you are not getting vaccinated, whether it's just simply due to you not wanting to get it or if it's a religious or medical exemption, you'll have to undergo weekly testing. Originally, I don't believe that was in the policy, and that raised a lot of concerns during the meeting because without that option, it could have led to staff just getting axed if they weren't getting vaccinated. So I think with this weekly testing option that will keep a lot of people on board. But we've seen with all the hoopla and the arguments against vaccinations, it could be a little topsy-turvy. Who knows?
And again, they need their first COVID-19 vaccine dose by October 1 and then a second shot, quote, within the appropriate time thereafter. We'll continue to watch that. Corey, you also went over to Northern Kentucky to talk about the way one district is dealing with the quarantines. My goodness, since schools have returned, we've seen school districts across the state of Kentucky have to close, Ohio as well. Northern Kentucky has been pretty well spared, although I'll note we just saw yesterday that the Newport schools are closing for a while due to quarantines. But you went to Ludlow in independent schools who have launched a program to try their best to keep kids in school. Tell us about it.
Right. So Ludlow Independent Schools is working with Gravity Diagnostics out of Covington in the Northern Kentucky Health Department to test students every day for COVID-19. So students will get to school starting at 7:30. They'll all get tested and then they'll be sent to class and then they can get full PCR test results by the next morning. The reason this is in place is mainly attributed to early on in the school year, 82 students within the district had to quarantine, which basically means roughly 10% of your students were out. And, you know, once you quarantine, you basically have to miss a week of school. So this is the best way that the district believes is the best way to keep students within the classroom and to keep them safe. And there's also a mask mandate in place as well, in case anyone had questions about that.
I got to ask you, Corey, while you were in the Ludlow schools, did any of the students bark at you?
Well, I wasn't in the Ludlow schools. I just spoke over Zoom with
you didn't hear any barking Michael. In the background?
Well, the superintendent didn't bark at me, so I think everything's A-okay over there.
Okay, I bring this up, Cameron Knight, because there are widespread reports, apparently, of students dressing like dogs and barking at each other, licking each other, hissing at each other, and also doing some serious vandalism in buildings. And one school district, Boone County Schools, came out directly and said, yeah, we are dealing with this, particularly at Camp Ernst Middle School in Burlington. Some students have faced some serious offenses. And tell us a bit about what we learned this week in this very bizarre tale.
Yeah, so there's actually two sorts of trends that are playing out side by side here. There's this, for lack of a better term, furry sort of pretending to be an animal in class or in school sort of thing, which was first reported out of Meade County in Kentucky, and has since, there's been a few other reports of it around the state. That's a smaller, maybe more localized situation, but it's a little hard to tell. Those school districts are trying to just tell parents to like maybe talk to your kids about this and let them know it's not appropriate to bark at people. The second sort of trend that's happening is a thing that's was called devious licks, which is which was a hashtag trending on TikTok for the last, I don't know, a couple of weeks, I guess. And in that sense, it started off with some kid posting him taking a box of masks from his school, like stealing a box of masks. And I don't exactly know how the name got developed. I'm not hip to all the lingo, a little out of the loop on that, but but since then, apparently, especially, well, nationally, it's been a national story all for the past couple of days. Kids from all over the country are breaking stuff, stealing soap dispensers, COVID tests. There's been some reports of someone stealing a toilet. They're just like vandalizing or stealing things from their schools and posting it on TikTok.
I mean, eight students in Boone County, according to the sheriff's office, have been charged. Yeah, I mean, four with vandalism, four with theft.
Exactly. Yeah, there's been some kids charged in Boone County. Oak Hills issued a statement today saying that they are seeing the exact same thing and that they are they're gonna press charges against the kids when they catch them. So that is that seems to be a more widespread issue and a national issue, and it's happening from LA to New York. There's reports of it all over the country right now. It's sort of taken off in the same way that Tide Pods, or a few weeks ago it was the crate challenge where people were trying to walk on crates.
You know, and the crates one was interesting because people were hurting themselves. The Tide Pod one seemed to be more of an overblown conversation than people actually consuming Tide Pods. But this sure. One really shocked me, the barking in the schools, because I saw a lot of the media outlets in town publish stories about it. But then in the comments, it's like, this is beyond one school experiencing something strange. Parents from all over, like this, my kid's coming home every day and saying that she or he was barked at, and it's just driving them all nuts. Now, Cameron and I think we're about the same age, so I don't understand children anymore. Corey, you're much younger. What is going on here?
Well, to be honest with you, Michael, it sounds more like a college dorm experience rather than a middle school experience. So all this is pretty weird to me as well.
I don't believe that. We were very well behaved at Norse Hall at NKU, so I don't.
Well, not so much at Murray State University where I'm from.
All right. Well, hopefully neither of you get bitten this weekend while you're out doing anything that you might be doing. But it's always a pleasure to talk to you both. Cameron Knight from the Cincinnati Inquirer and Corey Sharber from right here at WVXU. Corey, you've got a story to do, so get out there and do it.
Will do, sir.
All right. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much.
And the long-awaited Western Hills Viaduct Project is close to being fully funded, apparently. Let's talk about that with WVXU reporter Becca Costello. Becca, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
It's always a pleasure. So we've been talking about Western Hills Viaduct about as long as we've been talking about Brent Spence Bridge. What's different now as it relates to that project?
Well, first, I just want to reiterate how long this has been an issue. When I first started here in January as a reporter, I just kind of set up phone calls with all of the city council members and county commissioners. And I think every single one of them told me, Western Hills Viaduct is kind of our top priority. We have been trying to fund this for years. Up till now, it's a total cost of about $335 million to replace the viaduct. And the city only had about a third of that. I should say city and county only had about a third of that between local money and some state and federal grants. So the thing that really makes this project an actual reality is a new grant from SORTA, which is basically the metro, for $205 million total, or about $8.2 million a year for the next 25 years. And this grant puts them really within fitting distance, if you'll pardon that expression, of having the actual total cost of the construction. So in Mayor John Cranley's words, the money is there. We're ready to move forward.
So what's our timeline, do we think?
So the timeline is that the couple of things are standing in the way of starting actual construction, and that is a Duke Energy-owned substation that needs to be relocated. And also that area, if folks are familiar, does have quite a few rail tracks going through it. And so there's some negotiations that need to be done with the railroads about how to accommodate that. So the question really is, how long will those things take? Once the construction starts, it should take about 4 years to complete. Right now, the timeline is the new viaduct will be complete in 2028.
And we should note that this is for more than just cars. This is keeping with a lot of recent plans as it relates to transportation to offer protected bike paths and offer protected areas for pedestrians as well. And the design is much more modern than the historic structure that's that we're used to. So did anyone talk about how that's important?
Yeah, that's definitely been kind of a highlight of the project. And part of the reason why it costs so much is that it's not just a straight, you know, few lanes of highway to get from one place to the other. There was quite a bit of public comment on this over the past couple of years, and definitely heard feedback from the community that the sort of protected path was an important part of it. So a multi-use pass on the south side and then just a regular, much smaller sidewalk on the north side. But so that folks who are pedestrians or bicyclists can use the viaduct as well to get across town.
All right. Well, speaking of money and lots of it, Hamilton County, the government of Hamilton County, has about $158 million in federal stimulus still. And they're spending, I guess, some money on a consulting company to help them decide how to spend this money. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so the county has identified, they took quite a bit of public comment on what this kind of massive amount of money should be spent on, and identified these areas, kind of broad buckets of areas that they want to spend the money. A couple of examples, affordable housing production and preservation, that's obviously been a huge topic of discussion this year in the greater Cincinnati area. Public health, behavioral health, youth development, workforce development, et cetera. And so the county kind of identified those based on public feedback. And now they're saying, okay, what's the best way to spend this money so we can get the most bang for our buck? And decided that kind of the best way to do that would be to hire these consultants who have worked with other cities on the American Rescue Plan dollars, which is the latest round of stimulus, but also the CARES Act, which was the first round of federal stimulus last year. And so working with these consultants to kind of facilitate meetings with stakeholder groups like organizations and individuals and activists and decide, okay, how do we spend this money strategically instead of just kind of hoping that, you know, throwing money at a problem will help solve something.
Becca Costello is WVXU's local government reporter, and you're primarily at City Hall usually, although you have versatility, of course, but a lot of your reporting comes out of City Hall. And I want to note the headline that you had out this week. City Council asks city manager for new community engagement policy dash again. What's the story?
Well, it's a bit of a repeat of a story from about 6 years ago, which probably won't surprise anyone. It's not uncommon for things to kind of pass through City Hall multiple times before any action. But basically, current council member Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney introduced this ordinance, and it's based very, very closely on an ordinance pushed by former council member Kevin Flynn. And it basically asked the city manager to develop a more formal community engagement policy. So this would cover the mayor's office, it would cover council, it would cover all of the city's boards and commissions, and it would put in writing and enforceably, you know, what these city officials have to do to engage the community on issues. There was lots of public comment on this this week, talking about, you know, community councils don't get enough notice when there's development happening in their areas, or even just like a general issue that might affect lots of people, that people don't get informed about it until it's too late to be part of the conversation. So the difference between what passed 6 years ago is that was a motion. And what was passed this week is an ordinance. So it does have a little bit more force behind it. And one of the key parts, Lemon Kearney said, is that it requires the city manager to report back to council regularly, kind of updates on how the policy is being created and how it's being implemented, so that they can keep track and make sure that it's actually happening this time.
You can read Becca Costello's reporting at WVXU.org. You can find Twitter there as well and follow her updates as they happen from the city of Cincinnati. Also, of course, hear her reporting right here on 91.7. Becca, thanks for spending part of your Friday with us. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, Michael. Any assignments for me for this afternoon?
I'll think up something. Maybe I'll have you investigate this TikTok trend.
Oh, no.
Maybe you could just show me how to use TikTok and we'll call it even.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
See you later. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. What will the Archdiocese of Cincinnati and all that it governs look like a year from now? It's not entirely clear, but there is a looming reorganization. And here to talk about the Archdiocese Beacons of Light plan is Enquirer reporter Dan Horn. Dan, thank you for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it looks like the changes are being pursued because of a few reasons, according to your reporting, in which you basically cite the documents on the Archdiocese's website. There are fewer priests out there. The demographics of the local Catholic practitioners are changing. And frankly, there are fewer practicing Catholics. So talk a bit about what this plan hopes to address.
Well, basically, I think it hopes to address some of the issues that Catholics have been talking about and hearing about for years, if they've been paying attention. You know, as you mentioned, there are fewer priests. There are some pretty major demographic changes going on. A lot of schools and parishes are located in places where there, frankly, are just not as many Catholics as there used to be. And, you know, there's just a lot of demographic issues and long-term problems that I think the Archdiocese is trying to address here. And they've tried to tackle this in the past. Everyone's familiar with mergers that have happened in town between a couple of parishes here and there, school closings. They even about 15, 20 years ago began loosely grouping parishes together to try to share some resources, to share priests to some degree. But what they're doing now is far more dramatic. I think the end result here is going to be a much bigger change, a more profound change, because what they're saying is they're going to group parishes into these families of parishes. And the end goal is ultimately that these will become individual parishes, single parishes, where once you had two, three, or five parishes, now you just have one parish. You know, a lot of that, you know, we don't know what this is going to look like yet. We don't know specifically how parishes are going to be grouped. We don't know what schools may close or which parishes may consolidate. But we do know it's coming, and it's going to be a big deal.
Well, if you can help us understand a little bit more about that, and I won't name specific churches because we don't really know, so I'll just make them up. Let's say there's Saint Dan and Saint Michael, and then now Saint Dan and Saint Michael are going to be overseen by a single pastor. Does that mean there will be masses at both Saint Dan and Saint Michael, or does this mean Saint Michael might close and everybody has to go to Saint Dan?
It could be either or both of those things. We're going to find out more in just a few weeks of specifically what this looks like. You know, there's going to be groupings of parishes, some parishes much wealthier than others, some parishes with schools and some not, some more urban. So, you know, there will be some geographic connection to these parishes. There'll be in some rough proximity. For practical purposes. But beyond that, we really don't know how they're going to do this. And they're going to launch this in a few weeks. But, you know, if you look at these documents, if you look at some of the things they're saying, they're not talking about some loose affiliation here where people will help each other out. We're talking about mass schedules changing, priests being shared, potential consolidations and closures, parish councils potentially merging. Much bigger than anything they've done in the past.
Well, I mean, this is more than just mass and the organizations directly connected to the church at the center of a parish. As you note in your reporting, Dan, these parishes are the center of Catholic life in a lot of ways. This is where your kids play sports. This is where your aunt plays bingo. This is where the fish fry is on Friday during Lent. So
Absolutely. This
is going to be quite disruptive, possibly, to people who are still practicing in their neighborhood church.
Potentially it will be, yes. And I think the Archdiocese is well aware of that. You know, we've seen some mergers and closures in the past, and they are never pretty. And there's always going to be folks who are upset about those. There's going to be concerns about, you know, where they worship, when they worship, you know, where their kids play sports. And this could affect all of that. You know, mass schedules, maybe there's only going to be one mass at the church you currently attend. Maybe there won't be any. Potentially your kids could be playing sports at a different school. There's just a lot of different things that could be happening here, but in terms of just practical day-to-day life for Catholics. But at the end of the day, things are going to look very different when this is done.
We should note that what's happening here in the Archdiocese of Cincinnati is reflective of national trends. The number of Catholic priests across the country has declined by almost half since 1970, down from just over 59,000 to just over 35,500. And here locally, mass attendance is significantly down by more than a fifth, down 22.5% over the course of the previous decade, 2010 and 2019. And Catholic school enrollment also down 14%. And then the number of priests here dropped is projected to drop another 18% over the next 10 years. What are we hearing from local Catholics who may not be officials in the archdiocese, but they're just churchgoers and bingo players and fish fryers?
Well, I've talked to several, and I've talked to many over the years and over the past few months. Part of the problem is I don't really know yet how this is going to affect them. So I think broadly it's safe to say there is some concern about what this is going to look like. I think most understand on some level that the archdiocese needs to do something to address these changes, because the way it's built right now, it's built for, practicing Catholicism in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And that's not where we are today. And so I think there's a broad recognition that, yes, there is an issue here. But when it comes to how is that going to affect me and where I go to church and where my kids play sports and where Aunt Linda plays bingo, it's where I think you get a lot of people concerned. Because you're going to have parishes having to share resources in ways they have not done so before. Wealthier parishes helping poorer parishes. There's cultural differences in some of these parishes. Parishes are a very personal thing for Catholics. I don't think you have to be Catholic to understand that. I mean, anyone who goes to a synagogue or a mosque or a church understands that, they have a connection to those places. And if something's going to change, that can be very personal.
Well, we'll continue to follow your reporting on that, Dan. I should note, I attended both Catholic and public schools growing up. And at the risk of editorializing, I have to say, I bet there's no barking going on among the student bodies in the Catholic schools. Have you heard any reports of that?
I have not. I just learned about this from my son last night. And every time he tries to convince me TikTok is worth looking at, something like this happens.
It's hard to use if you're old, and it's hard to understand. And I don't know what's going on, but you're saying it's happening in your kid's district too.
It is. Oak Hills. Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
It is crazy indeed. Dan Horn, a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer, always a pleasure to have you on. We appreciate you spending part of your Friday with us.
Great. Thank you, Michael.
All right. It looks like it's going to be a rather pleasant weekend as Oktoberfest. Did I say Oktoberfest? Yeah, Oktoberfest gets ready to go down on downtown Cincinnati this weekend as we celebrate some German heritage. So if you do go out, please enjoy yourselves and do so safely. We do know COVID is still very much out there. So do what you need to do to protect yourself while also taking advantage of the opportunity to have a little bit of fun as summer finally turns into fall. And also a quick reminder, if you're a fan of true crime podcasts or TV shows, don't miss the next episode of our space podcast, Looking Up. It's out this week. Sam Keen, the author of The Ice Pick Surgeon, Murder, Fraud, Sabotage, Piracy, and Other Dastardly Deeds Perpetrated in the Name of Science, is the special guest. So Looking Up is available at WVXU.org or wherever you get your podcast. You can also get this podcast of Cincinnati Edition at WVXU.org, which you have been listening to. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our Facebook live stream was produced by Ronnie Salerno. I'm Michael Monks. I hope you have a great weekend, and we will talk again on Monday.